This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you, maybe right next door, right down the street. If you take the time to listen to some of those stories, you might be amazed, and your perspective on your own existence might change just a little bit. Each week, we visit with our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, so often we're educated, we learn a lot, we're entertained, and even inspired by these members of our greatest generation, like 96-year-old Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California. If you served with him in the U.S. Army Air Corps, you probably called him Steve, but that was long ago and far away. And so was Great Falls, Montana, where you grew up as the fourth out of seven children, smack dab in the middle. Was that the best spot to be in that group of seven?
I don't know. In those days, we had to wear hand-me-down clothes, and some of the dresses didn't work very good on me.
Because you were fourth, but two of the ones ahead of you were girls, huh? Did they really try to get you to wear the girls' clothes?
No, I was just kidding. Although, you know, we lived on a ranch and raised chickens, and the sacks that the feed came in for chickens was made of cloth, and they made them out of cloth that it could be made into clothes. Right. And some of the clothes that was shirts I wore were made of cloth off of feed sacks. Yeah. They looked good, and my mother was a great seamstress, and so it worked out all right.
And little did she know that you'd be following in some of her sewing footsteps during World War II. There's so many different duties people had in World War II, and we've heard so many different perspectives on this show, but you're going to hear one today you haven't heard before. I want to continue to explore, though, your childhood there in Great Falls, Montana. The Great Depression hits in the early 1930s for you. You're entering your teenage years. What was that like during the Depression, and how did it impact your family?
We lived, like I say, on a little ranch, and my father worked as a foreman in repairing the streets of my hometown. But being a big family and the circumstances, we didn't have very much as far as luxuries are concerned. But we did have enough to eat, but it wasn't very varied. It was what was the cheapest in the store.
And how young were you when you had to start working to help support the family?
When I was just 13 or 14, I was working for a widow woman and cleaning up her yard and everything, and got a whole 35 cents a day and my lunch. I heard later on that she complained to the neighbors about how much I ate.
I think every veteran that I've interviewed who was in the U.S. Army Air Corps, whether he was a pilot or otherwise, just about every guy who got into the Army Air Corps did so because he wanted to be a pilot. And you had those aviation dreams from a pretty early age. How did that start?
I learned to fly when I was 18 in a little two-cylinder airplane that cost me $8 an hour for dual instruction. I got through grade school. I wasn't intending on going to high school, but my dad was smart in a lot of ways. When I was asked if I was going to high school, I said no. And my dad says, well, it's a good thing you won't go. You're too damn dumb to go anyway. So that made me mad, and I went to school just to spite him, and I graduated from high school.
Yeah, you graduated from high school in 1938, and as you said, at this point, you've already learned to fly. Was there an experience where you saw an airplane, or you read about Charles Lindbergh or some other aviator, and it said, yeah, that's what I want to do? How did you catch that bug? Because everybody says they caught that bug.
I was about 12 years old when I first seen an airplane. They weren't very common in those days. Once I seen that in the air, That made me say I want to be a pilot. Of course, under the conditions, I didn't have very much money, so it took me a long time to be able to even solo. And this little airplane was a two-cylinder plane, didn't take too much gas, so that's how I got my flying in. I knew I could never afford to go to a flying school. Only alternative was to join the Air Force and go into flying cadets. At that time, if you had a high school education, you were eligible for flying cadets. But after I joined to get in there, I had to join up for 3 years at the time, and I was assigned to the squadron, but it wasn't formed yet. And so I was sent out to a bombing range in the desert where Edwards Field is now, and I stayed there a year on detached service, they called it, until my outfit was formed. By that time, they decided that you had to have 2 years of college to be a flying cadet, and so that left me out. And so they needed parachute riggers, so I was trained to be a parachute rigger. Sewing was part of parachute work and repairing and stuff, and I came acquainted with the sergeant that taught me how to fold chutes, and he became a good friend. And he said, do you want to get ahead in rank and in pay? And of course I did. And he says, well, there's a way of getting there by tests that they give every year. And if you are high scorer, they will give you rank and pay to go along with it. So he said, you've got a lot of time on your hands. He says, why not study, and I'll help you, and I'll give you a test once a week until the test is given. And under those circumstances, the first two qualifiers in the test were given rank and pay, and I got one of the two. I even got put on flying status. If you'd go out and get a ride in an airplane, I went all over the West Coast in airplanes. I never knew where we were at, but I was flying. Mm-hmm. So in about a month's time, I was from a PFC to a staff sergeant.
And when was it that you joined?
In September of 1940.
So, a little more than a year later, December 7th, 1941, yeah. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. Where were you? How did you experience that world-changing day?
I was packing parachutes, and one day two lieutenants came into our parachute deal, mm-hmm. and said, we're having a day when we're going to shut down the field and have like a circus or so. And they said that we needed somebody to jump a parachute, you know, for exhibition. And he said they figured as long as we were packing chutes, we ought to be able to get somebody to do it. So none of the eight guys that were packing parachutes opened their mouths. So I thought I'd be smart and say, well, you got to have special parachutes to jump exhibition. It has to be a larger chute than the regular chute, and then a spare chute for emergencies. And I says, we don't have any of those kind of chutes. The lieutenant says, if I get you one of those chutes, will you jump? So I was stuck. So I said, okay, I'll do it. I didn't think they could get the chute in the first place. And then a buddy of mine, he said, well, if you jump, I'll jump with you. So they said, well, we'll get you two chutes. And about 2 weeks later, here come two big boxes, and in them was the special chutes for us to jump. And so we practiced packing these special chutes and stuff, and it was getting close to the time when the show was going to take place, when Pearl Harbor came along, and it saved me from jumping.
How many days away was your planned jump when that happened?
Oh, it was about a month from the time that Pearl Harbor happened and the show was to take place.
And you were still in the Mojave Desert at this time?
No, I was in Fresno.
So you're in Fresno, and the news comes across that the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. What did that do to the guys on the base there? What was it, a big deal? Was it chaos? And what was happening?
Everybody started digging slit trenches around the barracks, and they shut down the field, and we were put on guard duty, shutting down the highways and stuff like that. And it happened to be kind of in the rainy season, and I stood out there in the rain for a while, and finally they needed somebody to man a machine gun on a Jeep. Well, my buddy had been in the infantry before he got in the Air Force, and so he knew how to operate a machine gun. He says, if you want to do it, he says, I'll give you a quick lessons in how to load a machine gun and get off a walking guard. So I says, okay, teach me. And so for about a month, I was manning a machine gun on a Jeep or patrolling the airbase. And then later on, they got regular guards to take over again.
So you described this, and in the immediate aftermath of this news that Japan has attacked America out on the Hawaiian Islands, the guys are really digging trenches around the base. Yes. You guys thought you might be under attack.
The B-24 bomber was just came into line, and one day there was a flight of B-24 bombers came in from L.A., and we hadn't seen them before, and we thought they were Japanese bombers. It really gave us a start there for until we found out they were our own planes.
Yeah, good thing you didn't shoot them down. So how long was it before you got sent elsewhere? Did you stay in Fresno for a while after that happened or no?
We stayed in Fresno for about a year, and then we were assigned to the 95th Bomb Group. So we went from Fresno to Walla Walla, Washington, and then from Walla Walla, we went to Sioux City, Iowa. And from Sioux City, we went to Rome, New York, which was a new airfield, and from then, we went overseas.
So this whole time, you're working with parachutes. What all were you doing with these parachutes? And I'm imagining most people have never seen or touched a World War II era parachute, let alone put one together or packed it.
I didn't know a thing about a parachute either until I was went to learn how to pack them. They had to be dried out every so often after they were in use. They had to be taken down and hung up in a loft to dry out. And at first, they had a deal that a parachute was, after being so old, had to be drop tested. Hammerfield or Fresno, when we first wasn't in operation, when I first seen Field, it was a bunch of weeds, and the runway wasn't even put in. We come in from March Field on a troop train and got out and marched across fields to get to our barracks, their new barracks. But it was quite a time before an airplane even landed in Fresno. So we used Chandler Field, and we first started drop testing chutes from Chandler Field. And I remember, of course, we were new at it, and we had a dummy to take place of a man, and we just threw him out of a cargo plane. The first one we drop tested, we had forgot to bring a rope for a static line, and so we came up with an old rope that was oil soaked and stuff, and tied it to the ripcord, and so that it would fall so far and then pull the ripcord out. But we made the mistake of not pulling the ripcord handle out of the pocket, and when it hit, it broke the rope, and the dummy and the chute fell down and hit the ground, popped up in the air about 10 feet, and then the chute opened. So that was our first experience in doing that.
And I imagine you're picturing that right now at home or in your car or wherever you're listening, the dummy slamming into the ground, bouncing up, and then suddenly deploying its parachute. There are a lot of things that Fred Stevenson saw in World War II that he had never seen before and hasn't seen since. And there's a lot more to his story. Before we're done, we'll hear how his ingenuity made a difference for airmen at his base in England, and also something that really changed Fred's perspective on life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.